Hey guys, welcome back to the Spates Waddlehead podcast. Awesome to have so many new listeners on board over the last few months, and awesome to hear so many people are enjoying these episodes. So firstly, before we get into this one, I do need to thank our major sponsor, Spates, for bringing you this episode. The absolute lads over there at Spates, and we really appreciate your support, so good on you, mates. Also, if you are enjoying this podcast and you want to support, go and get yourself some Waddlehead merch, whether it's for you, your dad, your son, your brother, even your friend, wife or partner. Anyone who you think is a lad deserves one of these items. To order, head over to waddlehead.com and go and get amongst. What a lad. Well, today I'm in the presence of greatness. Today's guest is widely regarded as the best shooter of a basketball this country has ever seen, where he scored thousands of points during his 23-year basketball career, which included playing 163 times for his country. He's the pride of the great town Reefton, and he is the greatest ever Nelson Giant. He's also been inducted in the Basketball New Zealand Hall of Fame, and of course he is an all-time lad. It is, of course, the Reefton kid himself, Phil Jones. Welcome, mate.
Thanks for having me.
Great to get you on, mate. Great to get a New Zealand Nelson Reefton legend on like yourself. And I'm looking forward to hearing some of your yarns, which I've been reading all about in the Ballin' and Black book recently.
Yeah, it's been, Nelson's like I call home now, but obviously grew up in Reefton and spent a bit of time travelling around the world playing basketball. So, done lots of cool stuff and, given a little bit back now through some coaching and, loving it.
Yeah, you're coming fresh off taking Waimea College to almost a secondary school title, lost the final, but that is still a huge achievement for Waimea College. Not traditionally a basketball school, but to take them all the way there, mate, your coaching must be right on.
Yeah, I'm lucky I've got a good group of kids. Probably a group that I've been working with since they were about 13, through sort of reps under 13s, and then, lucky enough to have all of them come through Waimea College. And we had an under 17 tournament this year, which we won the national under 17s with seven of those boys were at Waimea College, and the rest through Nelson College. So I've always got a quite a good group with those boys. And, we just went to Nats this year and we played awesome. Yeah. Just ran out of steam in the final, unfortunately, up against a strong Wellington College team, and got the silver medal.
Yeah, it hurts.
Yeah, it hurts a little bit, but great run for those boys, and they've had a heck of a year. 17 Nats took out the top qualifier for the Southern Zone for the secondary school qualifying, which gave us number one seed in the country, which Waimea has never had before.
Yeah.
And a silver medal, which again, Waimea's never been anywhere near the top.
Yeah.
Top eight last year, we got fifth last year, so it was nice to improve.
All right, that's so good. And you speak about the team, and obviously one of those guys, probably the star of the side, is your son, Hayden, who at just 16 years old, is he? And already playing for the Giants and has a huge reputation.
Yeah, he's getting a lot of notice through his play. And he's a good kid. Kat and I are very lucky. His mum, very lucky with the three of our kids. They've all been quite talented at what they've been doing. Maya's over in San Francisco on scholarship at St. Mary's for basketball.
Amazing.
Ava is 14 and she's really into it. And Hayden, kind of for me, I guess because he's the lad, the focus, and I've always coached him, and Kat's always coached the girls.
True.
That's kind of been the way it is. But Hayden, he's talented. He's 16, about 6'6". He's athletic. He can shoot it. He plays defense a lot better than his dad did. and he's getting a lot of notice, and he's just been over to Doha with the New Zealand under-16 team, and they finished second over there, lost to Australia in the final by three.
All right.
And he finished with 31 and 12, so he's a baller. Right. So it's exciting to watch them.
Oh, that's going to be cool to follow that journey over there. So the next 20 years and see where he ends up. But like, obviously three kids all playing basketball. How much did you guys sort of push them into basketball, or like how did they all become basketball like talents?
Yeah, I think it's probably hard for them not to become involved in basketball, just because when I was traveling around playing, the So Hayden and Maya were born in Italy. Mm-hmm. So I was playing over there and they sort of were immersed in the basketball sort of scene.
Yeah.
And then Ava was born in Auckland and I was still playing for the Breakers at that stage. So, you know, they've always had basketball around them. But from a young age, we've encouraged them to play lots of different sports. Mm. And I suppose it just got to the stage where Kat and I were becoming these taxi drivers and trying to ferry them around to all these different sports. We had to sort of say to them, look, you need to make a choice on what you're going to do. So they kind of got to around about 14, 15 and dropped one sport. Hayden was into his rugby.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when he was first played for the Wobbers.
Did he?
Oh, yeah, true. Yeah. You know, Maya and Ava are both playing netball. Ava's still playing netball, Maya played, but... yeah, but basketball kind of took over and, yeah, they've done some really cool stuff. Maya's represented New Zealand as well and Hayden's in that fold and I think Ava won't be too far away.
All right. That is crazy, eh? So what's the steps for Hayden like? Is NBA sort of the dream for him or?
Yeah, look, I think NBA is every young man's goal, right? Mm. A very small percentage of basketball players actually make it into that scene. Yeah. You know, the luxury, I think, and you probably noticed this with rugby as well, is there is a lot of leagues throughout the world that you can get involved in, yeah. And basketball's exactly the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's hugely popular around the world, and there'll be some form of competition or professional competition that he could get in and amongst if he wants to.
Yeah.
NBA would be awesome. I'm not going to say that's not a possibility for him, but yeah. I think that's a pinnacle, right?
Yeah.
And he's talented, so I think the next step for him is he's involved with the Giants. Mike Fitchett's doing a great job with him there and you know, helping him develop his game. And he just needs to get a little bit bigger. You know, he's tall and he's pretty lean, so he needs to put some muscle on. And, there's already a few colleges that are looking at him from the States, so that's a stepping stone. Get over there, perform well, you know, just increase your profile and your brand and then... maybe NBA could be an option.
Yeah, is that something you sort of look back in your career and sort of think, like, how you didn't end up making the NBA? Or because you obviously did the other, where you travelled the world, played in many different comps around the world and spent a lot of time here in Nelson. But do you ever look back on your career and think, wish I went to America or gave that a decent crack?
Yeah, look, I think I had a heck of a ride.
Yeah.
You know, and I've done some really cool stuff and, you know, I wouldn't change anything if I could go back. Going to college in America was something that was probably reasonably new back when I was, you know, coming out of school back in the early 90s. So it wasn't a common thing on the scene. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't something that I really thought about. And I was straight out of school. I started working at ASB.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Nenad Vucinic took me sort of under his wing with the Giants. And he was like, oh, you need to look at going to Europe because I've got an English passport through my dad.
Oh, true.
Yeah. So... I did have a school approach me straight out of school, but I'd started playing for the Giants and I was getting $100 a week to play for the Giants. That was a lot of money back in the day. and straight away, NCAA rules said, oh, once you've been paid, we can't touch you.
So
that kind of counted me out of that situation.
Those $100 a week cost me.
Yeah. You know, $100 a week could have cost me, you know, $10 million a year or something. Who knows? But so that pathway was sort of shut down pretty early.
Yeah.
Now it's quite different because the NBA is starting to become global and it's looking at different leagues around the world. The Aussie NBL is one league in particular that they really watch closely. Mm-hmm. You know, so that could be an option for Hayden too. And even with Maya, the WNBL over in Australia again. A lot of female players that play in the WNBA in America. So, you know, those options and pathways have really increased for kids these days. So I think there's a lot more opportunity to take a different pathway but end up in the same place.
Yeah.
So we'll have to wait and see what happens. But for me, I had so much fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, a couple Olympic Games, 3 world champs.
Yeah. Looking forward to going through all of this shortly. But where I like to start this podcast all the time is where you started and where you grew up. Everyone knows where you grew up. It's your nickname, the Reefton Kid. So tell me a little bit about your life in Reefton, growing up in Reefton.
Yeah, well, Mum and Dad still live in Reefton. In the same
do
house.
They?
Yeah, we grew up in, me and my brother Jono. And, you know, we were lucky. We had a really cool group of sort of kids my age that – and my brother's age that loved playing sport and parents that were really into it. My mum was the sporto in the family. Like, she's about 5'3". Dad's about 6'4".
Yeah.
He's from the UK, hadn't really played any sport at all until he came to New Zealand.
Oh, that's right.
He was 11 and a half stone, which is pretty skidding from my understanding. When he got out here, the first sport he played was rugby league.
Yeah,
but mum was into everything. And her brother, Donnie Ladner, he was a Kiwi, played fullback for the Kiwis.
Oh, yeah.
So their family was pretty sporting. And, you know, they used to ship us around and we'd play everything. You know, I think that was part of what I sort of considered to help with my development for basketball was we played every sport that we could.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just the cross-section of playing different sports and that type of thing helped me with basketball down on the later in the
yeah.
in the piece. I've got a bit of a nickname that's called I'll Play. So anytime I get asked to do something, I'll be like, yeah, I'll play. Yeah. I'll have a go. Yeah, Kat really enjoys that. So, you know, we were off down to Westport, down to Greymouth, playing all different sports, a lot of rugby. I played rugby through to about under 17.
Jerry, what position were you?
I believe it or not, I played first five.
Really?
Yeah. And then I ended up playing in the locks, and I could kick with both feet pretty good.
Oh,
I'm naturally left-handed and left-footed at everything, but I could kick equally as well with my right foot. But yeah, I just never got any bigger. Like, I got taller, I just got skinnier and skinnier. I was like, well, rugby's starting to get a bit rough, and basketball was taking over.
Yeah.
You know, I made the West Coast men's team when I was 15.
Oh, wow. Where did basketball start for you?
So it started in Reefton.
Yeah.
You know, we had our local community centre was where we played all our basketball. And we had, believe it or not, Reefton's got about 1,000 people, maybe greater in the greater region. And I sort of started playing when I was about 7.
Yeah.
And enjoyed it. Yeah, not something I enjoyed all sport. You know, I was into everything. I was actually a better tennis player than I was basketball player growing up. Tennis kind of, I was just me. And basketball was my mates, and
so it
kind of took over. The community centre where we played, it had no outlines. The walls were out. the three-point lines ran on the sidelines ran into the walls, so you couldn't shoot a three ball from the corner. You could only get to about just past the 45. And the backboards are about a foot and a half off the back wall, so if you're going flat tack, you're going to just slam into the back wall. So that was where I grew up. And learn how to play. Oh, and the other thing, the ceiling was quite low. So if you shot it too high, the ball just hit the ceiling and come straight to the floor. So
play on.
that was where I learnt to play basketball.
Oh,
right. And then the men's team, West Coast men's team, when I was about 15, first trip with them down to Gore, played in the tournament, walking into the stadium, and the stadium was on the back end of one stadium, of the stadium was a bar. So you walked in the bar entrance, and it was like a long sort of skinny bar that ran along the baseline.
Oh, yeah.
And there was two guys sitting at a leaner. One had a pint and a pie, and the other one had a pint. And they were sitting there smashing these things. And I was like, oh, okay. And we walked into the stadium, and then these two guys walked in behind us onto the court and started warming up for the second half. That was my introduction to men's basketball. So it was a cool place to grow up.
Yeah.
You know, very safe place. And I just, once I sort of fell in love with basketball, I'd go to the community centre, and I never had a key, but I knew how to jimmy the lock to get into the stadium, and I'd just go in and shoot for hours and hours and hours by myself.
Oh, true.
Yeah, and I put in heaps of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I believe that's why I got to where I got to.
Yeah.
Sort of that base, sort of just that enthusiasm and work ethic and just putting in the time.
And competitiveness, from all I hear, is that you were probably the most competitive person a lot of people have ever met or played with. Or
yeah, yes, I hate to lose. I've got better with it over time. But it could be said that I definitely got a bit of white line fever when I stepped over the line onto the court. I was in it to win it.
Yeah.
I think you need to be if you want to get to at a good level.
Yeah.
But I'm Hugh will tell you that I'm competitive at everything I do. So yeah. I think I'm beating him about 100-2 in table tennis at the moment. So I'm competitive.
Do you push that with the kids as well? Because obviously a lot of sport these days, especially for the younger kids, is trying to take that competitiveness out of it, like don't count the scores and everyone's a winner sort of thing. Or where do you sort of sit with that?
All of my trainings are run based on winning.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we split into two squads and we play best of three or, yeah. I think my Waimea college team is probably one of the most competitive group of guys I've seen, and that'll be partly because of how I am with it.
Yeah.
I push them quite hard. We have fun as well, and I make it, and we do it the right way.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not telling guys to go out there and, you know, smash somebody from the other team. I say you just play hard and compete and play every possession, and they buy into that.
Yeah.
I really struggle with sports where, you know, you can play for 90 minutes and ends up being in a draw.
Yeah.
So it's a waste of time. You know, like, you should be playing for a result.
Yeah.
So draws are not... not in my DNA, unfortunately, but I think from that competitiveness side, when I was younger, it was a problem for me because I was too competitive and it would cause arguments, and now I'm after nationals, I wanted to win, but I can understand why we didn't. Whereas previously I would have been like, you know, come on, like, we should have won that. And yeah, so I'm definitely getting better at that. Yeah. But I think to reach a high level, you've got to be competitive.
Yeah, mate, 100%. So then you move up to Nelson College from Reefton. Was that a scholarship for basketball, or why the move?
I had there was a guy by the name of Bill Delberg out of Nelson College who was coaching the college team with Steve Fitchett. That's Mike's dad. And they heard about a couple of guys down the coast that were going into their year 13 year group, and they said, they came down. So Bill came down with his son, Rob, and they trialled myself and this other guy, Nathan Perks, and we sort of played two-on-two and did a bit of shooting and stuff. And I think the reason that I went ahead of this other guy was because of my competitiveness. And Bill used to run around and he used to play and he used to smash everybody. And, and his boy was similar, but he was a bit younger than me, and we were playing two-on-two anyway. Bill, he smashed me, and I got a little bit annoyed with it. And then Rob came driving to the hoop, and I just took him out.
True.
And he goes, "You'll do." And that was it. And then the following year, I was up at Nelson College playing. Yeah, I had a great time at Nelson College. You know, even though I'm at Waimea now, and there's this thing that goes, you're a Nelson, Nelson boy. Hayden should be going there. And I said, no, well, I'm from Reefton.
Yeah.
I went to Nelson College for basketball, but, and I support the whole region. But I had a great time at Nelson College. Mm. And, unfortunately, when I was there, we got second at Nationals that year as well.
Oh, true.
Yeah, so I've been to the final twice at Nationals, and we got second silver both times. So
next year.
that year at college was cool. I loved it. And it really helped my basketball take off.
Were you boarding?
Yes.
Yeah.
Boarded at Barnacote.
Oh, did you?
I had no idea, the difference between, because apparently all the West Coast lads were in foul when I was there, and you had Rutherford, and Barnacote was kind of the house that had all the nerds and geeks and the different guys. But I don't know if that's the same now, but I enjoyed it.
And so after school, would you just be down on the court shooting, practicing, just?
Yeah. So obviously living on site in the gym right there, I was always in it. But we had a lot of training sessions. I started playing tennis as well, again, when I got back to Nelson College, and ended up playing for the college tennis team. Actually won the school championship for tennis.
Did you? Did you ever think about going down the tennis route?
Nah, it was... I just wasn't passionate. I just loved playing it.
Because it was individual.
Yeah, but the basketball was always so much more fun.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. So I ended up getting... So I won the tennis. We did really well in the basketball. I did quite good in the athletics. So I got Sports Person of the Year NC. Which I think annoyed a few people. But it was a fun year. Yeah, it was really cool. It sort of helped me develop a bit too. I met a couple of mates, never drunk a beer until I come up to Nelson, and I think I was drinking about 12 a week by the time I got home. Dad, mum and dad were like, what the hell's happened? So it was a cool time.
And at this point, did you think basketball was going to be a career for you?
I think we were – so I was involved with the Giants at that stage. It was mainly filling water bottles and turning out to practices, do a few drills, and if someone got hurt, would step in. But there was me and another guy, Brendan Bailey. I don't know. It wasn't something that I thought about as being a career.
Yeah.
I just enjoyed playing it, and I thought, oh, yeah, I'll play for the Giants. But I didn't – like, most of the other guys that played for the Giants also worked.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really a career as such. Yeah. So that was something that I was keen to do because I like watching the Giants, and I thought, oh, yeah, I could probably have a crack at that.
Yeah.
Got into the squad the next year, and that's where Ninad sort of took over and things started to happen.
Yeah, it all happened pretty quick for you from there, didn't it? Because was it your second year you guys won the comp, the Giants won the comp?
Yeah, so 93 we were terrible.
Yeah.
And then 94 we ended up winning it in Taranaki up there. And then sort of 95, 96, 97 it was a bit average again, and then ended up winning it in 98, and then the next one was like 2007, so there's a few big gaps. It was a fun time. And heaps of cool stuff happened for me. 98 was kind of the big year with the championship and then getting a contract in Europe and playing over there, and that's kind of when the professionalism and thinking, well, actually I could do this for quite a while.
Yeah, so you were playing for the Giants and working as a banker throughout that whole period?
Yeah, so I started off with, like, Westland Savings Bank was the original sponsor for the Giants when I first started playing back in 93. Mm. And then they got bought out by ASB, and so I was working for them. So I did about 5.5 years.
How'd you get into banking?
Just because I was playing for the Giants. I was out of school. A lot of the – so Western Savings Bank originated down in Hokitika on the West Coast. So all of those people that came up, they were all West Coasters, and there's all that connection. And they're like, oh, he's a West Coaster.
Let's get him in.
So I ended up working full-time for them.
Oh, yeah.
It was really cool. It was a fun time.
Yeah.
Just sort of did that for 5.5 years and then got a – Ninad said, oh, you've got a British passport, why don't you think about going to Europe? And I was like, well, he got me in touch with an agent. And then literally in the space of about 12 hours, I was flying to Europe to go and have a trial with Panathinaikos, which is like one of the biggest clubs in Europe.
True.
Yeah, it was.
What was that like? What's it like going to those trials? Like, what do you have to do?
So I flew from here, went up to Auckland to check in, went to the economy stuff, and they were like, oh no, you can't check in here. I was like, oh, what's that? You see, well, you got a business class ticket, so into business.
Business,
yeah, right. Yeah, so I'm 24. I've never done anything like it in my life. So business class all the way to Athens. The team was up and they were doing some pre-season training up in the mountains somewhere, so I ended up staying at a resort for about 4 days. Just put me up, pay for everything.
Just living the good life.
Yeah, it was crazy. And then the team came back, and I was in season with the Giants. So we had played 3/4 of the season, starting to head into the playoffs. So I was pretty fit and in good game shape. These guys were sort of not as fit and sort of hadn't played any games. So I came into the trainings and I did really well.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, we want to sign you for so not for this upcoming season, but the next season. I signed a 3-year deal. So it was 1 + 1 + 1, which equated to about $1 million New Zealand.
All right, better than the $100 giant payment.
Back in like 98. So that was pretty good money.
Yeah.
And then off the back of that, I flew to Finland. I flew to Sweden and met a Finnish team in Sweden and played in a tournament. And they signed me for the upcoming season.
Oh, to see out that year till you got to that next contract.
Yeah, so I went from the Giants to Finland.
All right.
Off the back of signing the Greek club contract, I'm 24, I've got a little bit of money to my name.
Yeah.
I had a sign-on bonus of $20,000 US, which they just transferred into my account just like that.
All right.
And so, US dollars back into New Zealand back those days was quite a chunky piece of money for a 24-year-old.
Yeah.
So I came home and I basically said to, I called the bank, the guy by the name of Bill Monk, who was my manager back then, called him and said, oh, look, I'm not coming back. I've signed this contract. And, and he said, don't blame you.
Yeah.
So that was it for the bank. And I came back and I had all this money in there, all this money in my account, finished off the Giants, won a championship. And I didn't have to be back in Finland until like November. And we finished late July.
Yeah.
So I had quite a few months before. And biggest mistake of my life, I just was like, well, I've got it made. So I got on the piss, had a whole heap of fun with my mates.
Yeah.
You know, went down to Dunedin, watched some, you know, games and come back. Travelled over to Finland and I was useless.
Yeah, oh, really?
I was so out of shape and didn't have any gameplay under my belt. And they were in season and I almost got to the stage in sort of January of that season of the season. So season started November, goes through to sort of March, April. Getting through to January, they were looking at cutting me. Yeah, and I was like, this is not good.
Yeah,
had double header that weekend. They said, well, if you don't perform this weekend, we're going to have to make some changes. And
that's pressure.
Yeah, yeah. First game, I had like 4 points and a rebound and fouled out. And and then the second game, I had a real good game. I scored 30 points or something. And they were like, oh, we'll give you another week. And then I started to come right.
Oh, yeah.
Got my confidence and started playing well. And ended up hitting the game-winning shot in the fifth game series of a finals to win a championship.
Oh, mate, how good is that?
So that was pretty cool, yeah. And that was my sort of first look at professional basketball.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mate, that's interesting. So you just sort of got on the purse.
Yeah.
almost blew it.
Yeah, almost. Yeah, and I think that was a real big learning curve for me. And, yeah. You know, I've always been the kind of person that is you know, play hard, party hard, you know, that I guess grew up in that era, and the professionalism just wasn't something that was at forefront.
Yeah.
That, you know, that's changed a lot now with the way, you know, athletes look after their bodies and all that type of stuff. You know, there's always a time to go out and have a beer or two, but I think there's a lot more focus on, you know, being ready for gameplay.
Yeah. So what happened with your Greek contract? Because I understand that didn't go through.
Yeah, no.
Never got that 1.1.
No, we ended up, so off the back of that finished season, came back, played another New Zealand season, went back to Greece. When I arrived, they'd changed the coach. They'd already selected the team. So the agent I was dealing with over there, he basically said, oh, look, we want you to stay a part of the Panathinaikos club, but we want you to play for a, so there's A1 and A2, which is like the top two divisions. Want you to play for an A2 team. Mm-hmm. You'll still get paid your money, which I thought was all good. Here's your new contract for the A2 team. I signed it. You know, young guy, not aware of anything.
Yeah.
Signed it. They effectively went, nah, that's it. We're not going to give you the money for the Panathinaikos club.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So I played for the A2 team. The first 3 weeks of being in Greece, there was a reasonable size earthquake that destroyed our gym, and it was pretty hectic. So we spent most of the season sort of playing, you know, training at 8 o'clock in the morning at 10:30 at night in different gyms around Athens.
Yeah,
and then played that year out. I stuck it out, and it was a good learning curve for me. It taught me that sort of kind of money is not everything.
Mm.
It's about getting in the right place in the right situation and making sure that you've got some consistency with the club. And the craziest part about it was I was fighting the whole time with Panathinaikos to get some form of payment out of them.
Yeah.
We got to the end of the season and I was the agent just was like, oh, the only way you're going to get your money is just to call the owner of the club and keep calling him. So that's what I did.
How many times did you call him?
I would have been for about a month.
Every day.
Ringing him every day, you know, you come on, you got to come up with something. And then about 2 weeks before I left to come back to New Zealand, I got a phone call and said, well, come in, we've got something organised for you. And I walked into the office and there was a table in the middle of the office. There was a few people standing around and there was about 60,000 US sitting on the table in cash.
Yeah.
And I just finished a training session. And they basically said, here's your payment, take it or leave it. And I just grabbed it and no lie, opened my sports bag up and just scooped it in and piled it into my bag, zipped it up and walked out. And I was like, I'm going to get mugged once I get out of it. But nothing happened. I just had this money in my bag, walked back to the house. And then I had to figure out how I got that amount of money back to New Zealand.
How did you get it back?
without implicating any crimes here. There was transferred as much as we could, and then the rest of it came back on our person.
Basically. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So you're carrying a fair amount of cash.
Carrying quite a bit of cash, US cash. Yeah.
Just on your carry-on.
Bit of carry-on, yeah, on the person. Did I declare it or not? That will stay with me.
Oh, far out! That is crazy. So then that falls through, and then you just come back to New Zealand.
Yeah, back to New Zealand, and then I ended up going back to Finland. So I played 3 years in Finland all up. I loved it over there. Yeah. It was cool. Freezing.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know.
Lucky you play inside, though.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Like, it's crazy. Like, it's colder here because, when you have, housing and things here, if it gets really cold here, it's cold inside.
Yeah.
But over there, you get inside, you don't know it's cold outside.
Central heating. Yeah,
radiant heating. Yeah. So, and even in the gyms and everything. But, coldest couple of days of the year that I was here around Christmas, it got to -32 degrees
below. Oh, wow.
That is cold. But on
I thought you were thinking like -2 or something.
No. -36. On average, a -10 to -15 was quite normal. Oh, right.
So just snow everywhere?
Yeah, snow. The coldest days, snow everywhere. The coldest days were the days where it was just perfect blue sky.
Yeah.
Freezing. Like absolutely freezing. When it had a little bit of overcast to it, and it wasn't as cold.
Did it get really hot in the summer?
I never spent a summer there.
Oh, you were
so, so it was always winter. But the first year I was there, when we won the championship, we got into started to get into like their spring, and you get the 24-hour sunlight.
Yeah.
So the sun's not up the whole time, but it's a reflection off a pole cap where it just stays daylight the whole time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they've got these block-out blinds in the apartment, so you know it's pitch black, so you don't know what's going on, but it's really odd.
It is like, crazy.
Yeah.
Dangerous for a night out.
Yeah, very dangerous. Yeah, hard to tell the time. But very cool people. Yeah. A lot like New Zealanders, quite laid back, like to have a good time, love their sport. So it was a fun place to
Language play. Barrier for you?
Language is something very different. But one of the things about basketball is the universal language is English. A lot of the places I played, lots of people spoke English. So it was kind of made things a bit easier. So it was a fun place.
Mate, sounds like good times. And one thing, obviously, we haven't spoken about your Tall Blacks career, but that all sort of started way before these contracts, wasn't it? So talk me through how your debut and...
So debut was 94, and we played against Australia over in Terrigal, just outside of Sydney, and we lost by 50. It was rough. That was back in the days of old Andrew Gaze and Vlahov, and they were pretty good team. Yeah. And we were still really young, and we had a bit of experience, we just weren't that talented.
Yeah.
So there was myself, Piero had just made the team, Mark Dickell and I went into the team together through a couple of injuries.
Yeah.
And that sort of kicked off my Tall Blacks career. And then I think through 90, sort of the back end of 94, 95, 96, 97, we had US tours where we went to America for about a month and we played against colleges and different teams. They weren't considered to be international, so that number of games that you read out earlier on, I think that's slightly light.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because there was, we'd probably average about 10 to 12 games on those trips.
Oh, true, so and they don't count.
They didn't count towards that number.
Huey needs to count those in his book.
Yeah, they only count them as internationals. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that was sort of the first part, and then we got into... When things kind of took off, there was a bit of a change in the coaching side of things, and the culture of the team changed a bit, and Yeah, we started to win games, and we'd had a group together, similar to like the Waimea team, a group of guys that have been together for quite a while, and the likes of myself and Piero and Mark Dickle, Paulie Henare, we've got Dylan Boucher, those guys that all sort of, Jud Flavel was part of that, Mika Vekona came on the scene, like there was a group that sort of been together for quite a while, and we started to just understand how to play together.
Is it true that your first actual start for the Tall Blacks, they had to have Ninad go and tell the coach that to give you a start, he had to tell him?
We had a trip to China, and the senior guys, so there's Ralph Lattimore and Ninad, were playing ahead of myself and another guy, and they were like, look, it's time that we start giving these, there's a couple of other guys in behind us that need an opportunity to start, and that without saying they're better than us, they're going to be better than us. And there was a real reluctancy from the coaching staff to do that, but in the end they did, and that was kind of, once we got in that position, we kind of stuck, thanks to them. Otherwise, it could have been quite different.
Yeah, that's fascinating. They obviously weren't as competitive as you were, because I couldn't imagine you doing that.
Ninad is very competitive. I think, when I said the culture of the Tall Blacks changed with the coaching staff that we had, they just wanted to compete.
Yeah.
They didn't want to win. And that was, that was something that Tad Baldwin brought to the Tall Blacks when he came in. He was like, but we're playing to win every game. So
you would have appreciated that.
I appreciate that a lot, I remember playing in the 2000 Olympics, and we had a pretty good team. We'd played a lot of international games leading up to that tournament. And we would always compete for the first half, like in our games. And then in the second half, we would fall away. And it was, I always believe it was a way that the bench was run.
Mm-hmm.
So effectively, everyone played the same amount of minutes. Oh. You know? And when you have sport, you always have your top players. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter what code it is, my thought is those top players have to play majority of the minutes if you want to be competitive. And we had quite a big meeting after one of the games that we'd lost that we should have won. It was against Lithuania, and I voiced my opinion. It's my competitiveness, and I was still a young guy back then, and there was a lot of agreeance with that. And even the guys that were, I'm sort of suggesting are not as good as the top five or six players on the team, they agreed.
Mm.
If for us to be competitive, we need to have our best players on the court. So we tried that for the rest of the tournament, and we did well. We only ended up winning one game, I think. But that kind of started that sort of understanding of this is how we need to play games. And then Tab came in the following year, and then, we beat Australia to qualify for world champs, and then we finished fourth in the world.
Yeah. Mate, world champs, talk to me about that, because that was a moment that I think every sort of New Zealander growing up remembers, that sort of tournament and how well it all went.
Yeah, well, I think that really, that sort of positioned New Zealand basketball to take off, and, not to, disrespect any of the Tall Blacks that have played for the team prior to that tournament, but that was the first big major tournament where we'd achieved, and it really sort of, basketball took off after, like, they kind of like a rugby World Cup win, or the soccer team's doing really well.
There's the Warriors.
Yeah, there's always like an influx of new players to the sport, and we had a massive influx of players to the sport at that stage, but it was, I think it was, we just captured the world with how we played together, and we won games that people didn't expect us to win. Tab and Ninad were a huge part of that because of their coaching and their beliefs and how to play as a group. And we had that group that had been together for quite a while.
Mm.
And we sort of, Tab really instilled that belief in us that we could win games. And we watched hours and hours and hours of video of other teams, which is something that was quite new to us. But, we played Russia in the first game, and Russia were a good team. There was no way that anyone thought that we would have beat them. And we came out and we beat them, ended up beating them reasonably comfortably in the end. But we were super prepared for that game.
What sort of stuff are you watching?
Like all game footage about how they play and, you know, their individuals and tendencies. And so that when, you know, when we're guarding, we know what they're going to do, whether they're shooters or drivers or passers. You know, this guy's a rebounder. This is their offense. This is how they run screen here. So,
so you're doing that as a team, not individually?
We do both. So we do it as a team and look at video, and then we look at breakdowns of individuals and what their tendencies were, and a lot of video. But the preparation was what got us here in the end, I think. But and that was the details sort of factor side of things that Tab brought. And Nenad.
And when you're playing in these tournaments, these big Olympics and world champs, you're obviously playing up against some of the best players in the world. Did you, how'd you feel going up against some of these, especially like American superstars and superstars from the NBA you probably were watching?
Right? Yeah. Like we played the Dream Team, well, they call themselves a Dream Team, in 2000 Olympics.
Yeah.
So that was the likes of Vince Carter and Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, those players. True. That was pretty cool. Yeah. And we got pumped against them. So that was our, sort of our first experience with them. Then we probably played them, I'd say, five or six times throughout the course of the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. But that was not always at major tournaments, warm-up games and things like that. I remember one of the teams that we played against was so this was probably the team that had the most famous players that you could think of in the NBA. It was Dwayne Wade, LeBron James, Tim Duncan, Sean Marion, Allen Iverson was there, Amari Stoudemire. Like there was a whole Carmelo Anthony, there's a whole raft of like young guys that were just coming in, and this was before the 2004 Olympics. So we played them in a closed door game.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, and we did really well against them.
True.
Yeah, a lot better than I think a lot of people thought we would do against them.
Yeah.
So that was a fun time.
Is it intimidating going up against guys like that, like in basketball? Oh, or how does it feel?
Yeah, I guess it is initially. But the thing with sport, the thing with next level sport, and you'd notice this with the rugby side of things, is just how the skill level is, you know, the athleticism is next level for them, but the skill level is not too dissimilar. It's the speed of things. It's how quick things happen. So you go from local NBL here to Aussie NBL to New Zealand sort of national team level. Everything just happens that much quicker.
Yeah.
So here you might have a second and a half to get a shot off versus you go to Aussie NBL, you might have a second versus New Zealand stuff, you might have half a second. Things are happening much quicker. What I noticed was once you got used to the speed of the game, there wasn't much difference. And that was for us, was just getting those regular competitive games against international teams helped us understand how the pace of play was.
Yeah, it's interesting. Eh? So the biggest difference, would you say, in terms of physicality or the mental side of the game, what was the biggest difference when you get to those high levels?
Yeah, well, you obviously play against the USA and they're super confident.
Yeah.
You know, and physicality-wise, I didn't think they were overly physical, but just more athletic.
Yes.
And they were bigger. You know, LeBron James is 6'8". And 110 kilos.
Yeah.
Probably do the 100 meters in about 10 and a half seconds. You know, you don't realize how big they are until you stand next to them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way it is with international basketball, is across the board, most players are comparative to where we are in New Zealand, like an inch or two taller.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have a taller point guard, a taller shooting guard, a taller three man, a taller four, a 7'5", you know.
Yeah.
And that's quite common.
Yeah.
So that's probably the main difference, is they're just a little bit bigger. But from a playing perspective, physicality-wise, I think New Zealand, having that rugby background, you know, and culture, we would consider one of the more physical teams around.
Yeah.
Yeah. And which is what we kind of hung our hat on.
Yeah. And I guess you'd always back yourself to shoot as well.
Yeah. We had myself and Kirk Penny and, you know, sort of running the wings and, you know, good shooters. you know, Piero would knock down shots when he needed to. We would grind it out, and that's what we were there to do. Yeah. You know, shooting was sort of my thing and Kirk's thing, and you know, we were pretty good at it.
Yeah, and the game sort of changed, I feel like, what, since Steph Curry's come in terms of the shooting in basketball.
Yeah, 100%. It used to be, everything used to be at the rim and in the paint and post up and big man. But now, if you don't have five guys on the floor that can shoot, you know, there's something wrong.
Yeah.
It's definitely changed big time. You know, the 3-point shot has changed the game massively. Mm. And someone like Steph Curry, who just comes down and fires it up and, you know, setting shots from 2.5-3 meters behind the 3-point line is, I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, because you get a lot of kids these days that are taking those shots, but they're not actually that good shooters, you know, they're just firing it up. But that's definitely changed the style of play.
Yeah.
And it's created a lot more space too, because if you've got guys that can hit shots a couple of metres behind the 3-point line, if you're not defending them out there, then, you know, or if you are defending them out there, then there's just so much more space in behind them. And the, you know, one of the things that I really promoted with my Waimea team was shooting, and I really pushed even the sort of non-shooters to shoot.
Yeah.
And eventually they kind of buy into it and they get confidence. And we put up a lot of shots, but it's just a repetition thing at the end of the day.
So if you were starting post, or if Steph Curry had his career before yours, do you think that would have changed your career? Like, obviously Hugh believes that you would have 100% been drafted in the NBA if you played post the Steph Curry era.
Yeah, I think I think there could have been opportunity for me on that side of things. Mm. It's a different game now than what it was. And I also think the NBA is sort of, they now recognise that that basketball is a global sport. It's not just... it's just USA based sport. So there's a lot more opportunities. I think if I was having my career now versus, you know, 20 years ago when I had it, there could be an option for me to be somewhere involved in the NBA or some form of, you know, bigger league in Europe or, yeah.
Mm. But, interesting, yeah. Hey? Yeah. Fascinating how it all works out. But speaking of shooting, like, obviously one game when you come back to New Zealand, 104 points, was it? Was
it? Yeah, 105.
105. I've sold you short by one. Yeah. How do you score 105 points? Like, that is unbelievable.
Yeah, it was a club game down in Dunedin. Myself and another guy and one of the other Nuggets, Hayden Allen, we lived together.
Oh, yeah.
And we were both sort of vying off for the scoring title for the club competition, and he was giving me a bit of a stick about it, and I was giving him a hard time, obviously.
Competitive.
And he sort of said to me, because it was my last game before I had to take off overseas again, and he said to me, you know, I've got you on the scoring title, and I was like, oh, I don't know, you know, we'll have a look at it after the game. And so we're playing, and we just finished a Nuggets training, actually.
That night.
We'd literally gone from Nuggets training to the game. First tip of the jump ball comes straight to me. I turn around, take like one dribble, like Steph Curry, about a meter and a half behind the 3-point line, just let it fly straight through.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that felt pretty good.
Yeah.
And then halftime comes, and I've got 53.
Far out.
Yeah, and I go over to Hayden, who's playing on the other court, and he's at halftime. I said, how you going, mate? He goes, oh, yeah, I'm going pretty good. I got like 20. I was like, oh, that's good. Yeah, and he goes, how you going? I said, oh, I've got 53. I'm just going to go get some shots up, warm up. And he's like, what? We get over to the end of the game. Like, I was just hitting ridiculous shots, you know, just turning around, firing up. It's just going through. You know, guys are tipping it and it's still going in. And, you know, I probably believe that if I'd stopped it halfway and tried to kick one, it probably would have gone in. You know, it was just one of those games where everything just went in.
Yeah.
We had stats for the game. So I ended up taking 51 shots for the game and I made 41.
Wow.
So I missed 10. I was 23, I think 23 or 24 of 27 from three.
Shit, that is a night.
Yeah, so, you know. Didn't have many assists that night, but yeah. So the team I was playing on, they just kept finding me and feeding me the basketball, and the rest is history. Really.
Mate, that is crazy. Yeah. How do you celebrate a night like that? Because those obviously don't happen too often.
No, so we did celebrate. It was a Tuesday night. We went to the bowler because we were the bowler Celtic, by the bowler. The bowler's no longer there anymore. And we just really got on the piss quite hard. I remember we had jugs stacked up to the ceiling in the bowler. And then we had – so the bowler put on the night a celebration night for the team, a night of 105 jugs for free.
Oh, yeah.
So they had a big blackboard up behind the bar, and they literally had one to 105, and they just crossed them off as we went. And so we celebrated twice. The first time, though, the TV1 News got wind of the 105 points, and they were like, oh, we want to come down and do a segment on you, and but we'll be in Dunedin then Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, okay.
This is after the night.
After the night, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I was real dusty. I turned up and there was a woman there and a cameraman, and they were like, okay, can you do a little bit of shooting and stuff? And I started shooting, and I was just wrecking everything, like seeing three hoops. And the woman, I'll never forget it, the woman goes to me, are you sure you're the right person? And I was like, yeah, I am. I said, why don't we just do some dribbling instead?
500 takes later.
Just to make one shot. Yeah, that was hard case.
Oh, that's crack up. So, and what would be the next biggest score? Like 105 seems ridiculous.
Yeah, I've had a few 40-point games in the New Zealand NBL.
Oh, yeah.
I had a 40-point game for New Zealand over in China.
But 40 points is about
the next best. Yeah, I don't think.
So 105 is out of this world.
Yeah. I probably had a few 50-plus point games in NBL, in club competitions here.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think from, like, when you're talking about at a high level, that would be sort of where I'm at. I had a big game against China at the World Champs in 2002. I had 33.
Oh, yeah.
So when you're scoring that sort of level in international games, that's pretty good, because you're generally playing against a very strong opposition that would figure out a way to try and stop you.
Yeah, and when do you know pretty early, like you mentioned in that 105 game, like that first shot, you knew that it was feeling good, or like is that the same in all games? Like when you hit your first few, you feel like you get this flow and your confidence just grows and you start hitting more.
Yeah, you start to get into like a zone where things just. You're not thinking about anything. And I think that's – I get asked that a lot when I've played in games, and they go, well, what were you thinking about when you're playing? And the thing is, you're not.
Yeah.
Like, you're just in this zone where everything just happens.
Yeah.
And you let – your body takes over, and it's just the repetition of putting the shots up. And, I think the worst games I've had is actually when I've been actually thinking about every single shot, and I've made it and missed a shot. I'm like, oh, I shouldn't have missed that. And, and then I start thinking about it.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're just playing, it just happens.
Yeah. How did you get out of those nights where, you throw a couple of dusty old ones early? How do you flip that mindset around?
Just keep shooting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the biggest lessons for me was, I'm a shooter, and the worst thing I could do is stop shooting. So I just shoot my way out of it. And it could get ugly for a period of time, but then eventually it's just you just see one go through the hoop and it can change everything quite quickly for you. But I've had periods where I've gone through games where I just haven't been able to make a shot.
True, like a whole game.
Yeah.
And just...
Yeah, and I'm not doing anything different.
Yeah.
It's just one of those And there'll be unlucky things where you'll make one, but the referee's blowing the whistle as you're taking a shot because there's been a foul on the other side of the court. You finally see it go through the hoop, but it doesn't count. And that just compounds the frustration. That's just – I've got a young guy on my team at Waimea, and he can shoot like crazy. Not the greatest athlete, but his job is to shoot. Right. And he gets on fire, and he's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
But he's gone through a period recently where he's just really struggled to make shots, and he can't figure out why. And I said, it's just that, it's just this period of time. You know, you're not doing anything different. You're taking the same shots. They're just not going in.
Yeah.
I said, you just got to shoot your way out of it.
It's tough mentally. Yeah, it's a good mental battle. For a kid like him,
for someone like him, it's really tough.
Yeah.
You know, I said, you'll be right. You'll be fine. You'll come right. Yeah. And he just needs to see a couple go through the hoop. And,
Well, mate, he's got the right person in his ear talking him through it. But obviously another thing I want to talk about is the start of Breakers, or when the Breakers formed, and sort of what that meant to New Zealand basketball as well.
Yeah, that was it was quite a cool time, I think, for basketball in New Zealand. Like it was, I think we thought we were going to win the championship, you know, like we came out. We had effectively the New Zealand team and then a couple of imports that were added into it. The setup was probably, in regards to, you know, like we had our home base was at the Millennium Institute in Auckland. We played at the North Shore Stadium. A few of the Tall Blacks boys were sponsored by Grand Jeep Cherokee, so we were rocking V8s down the, you know, the motorway. And so the hype and everything was quite cool. Yeah. And we won our first game in overtime against, I think, Adelaide.
You had it, surely?
No, we I hit the first points for the Breakers.
Oh, did you?
Off a little run of play, off a three-pointer, off a turnout.
It's a good trivia question.
Yeah, yeah. we scored 44 points in the first quarter.
Oh, far out.
Yeah, like we just came out. We were hot.
Yeah.
Like we just made shots and we were pumping Adelaide. And then eventually they caught up and we went to overtime. We won in overtime. And we partied like we'd won a championship, and then we lost 10 games straight. And then Jeff Green got fired, and, it was a pretty crazy time. And we ended up missing out on the playoffs by about a game.
Oh, yeah.
So we were almost there. But that was a fun year in respect to that basketball again had taken off with another team, like finally got a team in the Aussie NBL. It was nice to be a part of it, but it just – after the year that I'd had, I'd come back from Europe to play in it. I was at Italy at that stage. I had a good year in Italy. And I only had 1 year there, and then I came back and played for the Breakers, and I was like, I don't know whether I want to stay. So I ended up going back to Europe again for another 3 years and played in Italy for another three.
And those decisions, what's the benefit? Is it financial? Was it just enjoying it more, or a bit of both?
Yeah, I think there's probably a bit of both. Financially, it was better in Europe because we got a vehicle given to us, we got accommodation paid for. So all we really had to pay for was our food and beverage and phone, and that was about it.
Yeah.
Whereas back with the Breakers, you had to find your own accommodation, get a vehicle. So it was financially, it was better in Europe.
And your family enjoyed living over there?
Yeah, we had our first two kids there, so Myra and Hayden were both born there. It was really cool. Italy was an awesome place. Food was next level.
Yeah.
But just the passion of the fans.
Different.
Yeah, we had 5,000-seat stadium, which was jam-packed every single game, and they were just nuts. We'd come out after games, and my ears would just be ringing from playing in the stadium. And the town lived and breathed basketball. If we won a game, it was just pumping. And then if you lost a game, if the team lost, there'd just be no one.
Yeah.
It'd be dead.
Yeah.
Kat would tell a story that I was very reluctant to go to the supermarket after losing games, not because anyone would say anything to me, but it was just the vibe, my two favourite places to play was Finland and Italy in Europe, and Italy was just amazing.
All right. So were you quite a well-known person over there? Like, could you walk down the street?
Yep. Once, after having a season there and doing quite well, and then going back and having another couple of seasons there, everyone knew who you were.
True.
Yeah.
Was that the same for you here in New Zealand?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So not so much anymore. Yeah. There's the odd person that noticed me, but back through that sort of era of 2002 and through the 2000s, you'd go anywhere and people would know who you were.
Yeah.
Like that Tall Blacks team that did well.
Yeah.
The profile of basketball just took off like crazy. So I'd go to, like, playing for the Giants at different NBL games throughout New Zealand. Yeah, go down the street and, lots of people knew who you were.
Yeah. Mate, and I'm guessing basketball is such a small community here in New Zealand, or I guess around the world as well, because especially when you play for so long, all the people that you would have met or played with or played against, it's such a small circle. You'll be meeting those people all around the world.
Yeah. You know, at the moment, we've got this sort of next stage of those. So my kids and Dylan Boucher's kids and Piero's kids. So there's all these kids coming through that are starting to play secondary school basketball or early stages of NBL.
So
that second layer, which is quite cool. So carrying on that name. So that's awesome. It was a super fun ride through that 2000s period with the Olympics and the World Championships, and just the, I suppose, basketball got on the map a bit more with that, particularly in a national level here in New Zealand. Mm.
So how did it all finish for you? Was it body, or was it time was done?
I dragged it out, retirement after retirement after retirement.
Tired about three times.
I think it just got to the stage where the body just had enough. And kids were starting to take over a bit more, and I probably should have finished sooner than I did, because I'm starting to pay for it now with the old body. But yeah, I just loved it, and my competitiveness kept me in there. And even at 40, I think I've played my last games when I was like 44. I was still having my way with the younger guys. They just just not smart enough. It's amazing what you learn. What you understand when you're older from experience of, rather than running like a big banana cut to get to point A from point A to B, if I just run in a straight line, it's much faster.
Yeah.
Who knew that was, if I'd known that when I was 24, it'd be a completely different story, but you just don't. Yeah, but there was sort of the first part of when I decided I was going to give it up was actually to do with some coaching. Coach that we had here come for the Giants, and just didn't enjoy being involved with him. And that kind of just, I lost a bit of the enjoyment out of it. So I decided to pull the pin. But then a new coach came on board, and I knew who he was, and he was like, come on. And he was like working me pretty hard throughout the summer, and I was like, okay, I'll come back and play. And I'm glad I did. I enjoyed it, because it was, I still had plenty in me to play at that stage. And came back and enjoyed the season and played for another couple, and then that was it.
And what was the hardest thing once you had left the game? What did you miss the most?
I missed the training most.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah, I love the I love going to training, and I love competing at training, and that was the thing I enjoyed the most.
True.
Yeah. I enjoy playing games, but the training was real. I just enjoyed it. Enjoyed going and running around and scrimmaging and competing in all the drills, and I suppose just still showing that I was the top dog, you know?
Yeah.
That was the most enjoyable part.
Oh, that's interesting, eh? Not many people say training. Training's usually one of the things the guys, look forward to getting away from, but you obviously love it.
Yeah.
And did you find your own personal training, like once you'd finished, did you find it easy to stay fit, or...?
I was never a big guy that would go out and pound the roads and run to stay fit or anything like that. I kept playing at a sort of club level, and I love playing golf. That's my new vice. So that sort of keeps me, I guess, active. My hip's buggered, so I can't do anything on that in regards to doing any sort of physical activity, so that sort of holds me back a little bit. But the fitness side of things is definitely lacking at the moment. I would do go out and ride a bike and nothing serious.
Sounds similar, because I obviously got the same sort of hip issues as well, but it is hard to keep that physical activity up with a buggered hip. But you've got a hip replacement coming up soon, so you're going to be fixed shortly.
Yeah, show my age. It's not even an age thing, it's just I've wrecked it. I hurt my hip over in Greece when I was playing. I was playing in a game and got a rebound, and a guy just came flying, and he fell into my leg. My hip, I felt my hip go out and come back in. almost like a
dislocation.
And I had massive problems with that area, particularly in my groin, for the next couple of years after that. I remember getting a cortisone into my groin, which was, you know, the needle was about 6 inches long, and it was lying on your back, put everything to the side, and the needle just went straight in, straight up into my groin, into my hip area. That was brutal.
Yeah.
Did the job, but it just kind of masked what was there, and now I'm paying the price for it.
Yeah. So what does it look like now for you? Like, what does it feel like?
So the main problem is with so any jumping or like running or anything, it really makes it angry. Twisting movement. So you know, with if I lay on my back and if I move my foot to the left or inwards, it just catches.
Yeah.
So the inside the joint, you've got, I guess you have like a lining. The lining is you generally are about a centimetre thick. X-rays show that mine's about 2 millimetres at best. So that's starting to see that there's a bit of bone-on-bone stuff going on. And I've got a calcification out on the exterior of the hip joint. And I assume that when I do the twisting movement, that's catching on that calcification.
So good explanation, mate. You could be a surgeon.
I've had a number of x-rays. It's been a long process to get to this point. And then my surgeon decided to go and break his thumb the other day on his mountain bike. So it's been pushed out for another month. But, I haven't YouTubed it. Apparently you can't. I just don't know whether I want to go that far.
Nah, don't look.
Then they give you a couple of different insertions. So there's an insertion into the femur, which is, if you're older, it's just a spike. It's for less active people. And then the other one, which I'll get, will be, it's a bigger post that goes into your femur, and it's kind of like a cheese grater.
Oh, yeah.
And the bone grows back through it.
True.
The surgeon's saying that I should be able to get back to playing some basketball. It won't be competitive.
Back to the Giants, he comes.
Yeah, but it'll be I'd love to go and play some Masters stuff. I know a couple of guys that have Scott Gibbons. He's had both of his done, and he's done, I think he did the Coast to Coast recently. He's looking to do it again.
Yeah.
So if you do the right training and you there do the hope. Rehab, there's opportunity to get out there and just lead a normal life.
Yeah. How good's that? There's hope for me as well. So you speak about wanting to play for Masters and et cetera. What else is the plans for you going forward? I know you've tried a bit of coaching with the Giants. You're coaching your kids at the moment, but what's the long-term plans for you? Where do you see yourself?
I'll get through the school stuff first. Hayden's got another year. Whether or not I decide to stay on again, I don't want to just drop the whole school thing after the kids leave, but one of the things with coaching them is for any of the trips that we do, like nationals we've just been to, or rep stuff or qualifiers, I have to take annual leave from work to go and do it.
Where are you working back at the bank?
I work at ANZ.
Oh, yeah, you're back there.
Yeah. So I'm mobile.
They took
manager.
You back.
So different bank. But so I do a home lending role for them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so having to take leave from work to be able to go and do these trips we're going to have 3 kids that are going to be spread out across the world. It'd be nice to be able to have that leave to go and see them.
Yeah.
So that'll be something I'll have to consider once Hayden's gone. Like the Giants side of things is, Giants has had such a big piece of my life for a long time, 23 years with them. I just don't know whether I could commit that amount of time again or commit time to them to, I like being involved from a distance. I catch up with Mike Fitch, the coach, every now and again, have a bit of a chat about things. But I don't know whether I could stand on the sideline and be, coaching. Although, with Hayden involved in the Giants last year in the squad, I was at quite a few trainings just watching.
Yeah.
So Fitch is probably going there going, well, if you're going to be here, you might as well come and coach, I just don't know whether I want to get to that level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And would you look to move over to America if all your kids are over there?
No.
No, you'd stay here.
I love Nelson.
Yeah.
Kat loves Nelson. We've got a nice little setup with their home. And you know, good friend group. And we love it here.
Yeah.
And I always sort of said when I was playing, after spending a year of school here and then doing the Giant stuff, and I always said that I would end up living here.
Mm.
I didn't want to go anywhere else. Mm. And our kids are going to move on, and it'll be nice for us to stay in one place and have a base for them.
Yeah, yeah.
And they can come back whenever they want.
Yeah.
There's always a place for them. But it's time for them to, you know, Maya's now moved on to her next stage of her life. And she will come back to us,
yeah,
you know, over the next 4 years and then see what happens. But, we're not planning on picking up and shifting anywhere soon. We want to stay.
Mate, what a spot to settle down in, house, and geez, can't be beat.
Exactly.
Well, anyway, I've gone to the Instagram for some questions, and millions have come in for you, mate. There's lots of good ones here, but who is the real Reefton kid, you or Marty Banks? So this is obviously, I think it's a big question that gets thrown around Reefton.
Yeah, I guess the question to the question is, how can you have a second Reefton kid when one's already been named? I got a lot of time for Marty. Yeah, he's a good guy. And I grew up playing sport with his brothers. He's a little bit younger than me.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, there's only one Reefton kid.
Yeah.
And it's not Marty.
I remember going to the Reefton races, must have been a fair few years ago, but you were having a sprint race with Marty Banks.
Yeah.
Halftime entertainment.
Yeah. Not by choice. And I think too, like, at that stage, I would have been still in my 40s, and Marty would have been in his 20s.
He's in his prime.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen a 20-year-old Phil Jones versus a 20-year-old Marty Banks.
Have you got him?
I think I've got him.
Yeah.
It was pretty quick back in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it would have been touch and go on the finish line, I think.
So that explains that, the real Reefton kid.
We did have... I like to go down to Reefton and play in the golf tournaments down there.
Oh, yeah.
And one year we went down and Marty was down there, and I remember having this huge argument with him. It wasn't even an argument. It was a bit of banter about in one of the pubs there about who was a real Reefton kid.
Yeah.
and someone caught it on video. Someone's got it on footage. If you get your hands on it, it'd be quite funny.
Well, I'll be able to track that down, surely. Yeah. So he reckons he is.
Oh, he likes to say he is. But there's no statue of him in Reefton. It's just me.
Is there actually a statue?
No, there's not.
Oh, geez, I was going to say. That claims it. Okay, next one. Greatest coach you ever had?
Well, that's a tricky one. I think there's been a lot of coaches throughout my whole career that have had a big influence on my playing career. Nenad Vucinic would be the one that's probably had the biggest impact in regards to pushing me to go to that professionalism side.
Yeah.
Bill Dalberg obviously helped me kick off in regards to getting to Nelson and then playing for college and then getting in the environment here.
Mm.
Tab had a huge impact on a team environment and how we played. So those three have been really instrumental in my career. Hard to pick any one of them. Obviously Mum getting me involved in the sport and showing me everything that I knew from a young tacker. But those three have had a big influence.
Did your mum coach you in terms of your basketball?
Well, Mum kind of kicked it off for us. Dad ended up coaching us. He's probably more of a manager than a coach. I hadn't played a lot of basketball back in the day, but he was passionate about it. Mum was definitely the sportier one.
That's interesting. Okay, next one. What's your record for most threes made in a row?
Oh, we did a lot of shooting drills up at the Breakers when I was playing up there and had to make a certain amount of threes. And I think there was a 2-minute drill where we had to shoot and rebound your own shot and get it and shoot and rebound. So I think it was 2 minutes. I made 22.
Fire out.
In 3 minutes. I didn't miss in the 2-minute period. So that's shooting and rebounding and getting out to 3-point line and doing it. So
even to get 22 shots in is pretty good.
I was moving pretty quickly. We used to do a lot of shooting drills with the Giants. We would shoot sets of 25. And I'd quite often make 25 in a row out of 25. There'd be a lot of 20, 24s and 23s. I couldn't tell you how many in a row I'd hit. Yeah.
What about free throw?
Free throws, quite a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, in hundreds. I think probably around about 390.
390? Yeah, in a row. Wow, that is impressive.
Yeah, so, one, I preach free throws big time with my school team.
Yeah.
Because that is the one thing that most young shooters are terrible at, is shooting free throws.
Why is that?
I just think lack of practice.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just, it's not one of the things that they really focus on. And I guarantee you at the end of every tight game, there'll be half a dozen free throw shots.
Yeah.
And they're the most important shots in the game.
Yeah. The one thing that you can control in the basketball court,
like you got no one guarding you. You're just standing there. It's just you and the hoop.
Yeah.
And it's one of the toughest shots in the game.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Far out. It's interesting. Even though you can hit 390 in a row.
But in the context of the game, there's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. And you feel that pressure?
You can, yeah. Like I was good at free throws, but there's a lot of good shooters that aren't.
Yeah,
you know, like Kirk Penny was a great shooter, but free throws at times let him down.
True.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah. Eh? Okay, next one. What does New Zealand basketball have to do better to consistently crack the top 10 teams in the world?
I think have all of their horses in the stables.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tough environment because I think professionalism has changed things a little bit where the national team is probably not the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas back when I played, it was. You know, everyone wanted to play for the national team. But that's the player's choice. You know, I don't hold anything against anyone who chooses not to play for New Zealand, but I think for me personally, that was the biggest pride about playing basketball, was being selected for a national team and playing for it. But I think for New Zealand to be competitive, to be super competitive and get in that top 10, because to get into the top 10 is not easy, is to have the likes of Stephen Adams playing, have the Webster brothers playing, you know, all of the top level guys, if you can get all of them together and make sure they play at every single big event, that will help the team achieve a bit more. But it's just not that easy. You know, and the way that the national programs change and they have games throughout the course of the year, you've got different guys that are available and different guys that aren't, and it's just the nature of the beast, you know. But when you have those big tournaments, I think for us to really go next level, got to have those guys involved.
100% makes sense. Okay, next one. How loose did the Tall Black trips get back in the day?
No comment. Who asked that question?
Oh, one of the old Tall Blacks, probably.
Like I said earlier, we had a growing up in that sort of early age of the professionalism, it was still that play hard, party hard sort of, I guess, thought process.
Yeah.
So we were, when any opportunity we had to go out and have a good time, we would have a good time.
Yeah.
You know, did it get loose? Sometimes. Yeah, but we, you know, we weren't always in an environment where it could, so had to be careful.
Pre-social media times, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely pre-social media times. So it's a much more difficult for, you know, for professional athletes to be a little bit stupid and get away with it.
And I guess basketball, you always seem to have quite short turnarounds too, don't you? So
tournament play and stuff, you don't have a lot of time to rest. You know, it's not like the World Cup where you've got a week or two between games. You know, with basketball, you're playing games day in, day out.
Yeah.
So there's only really the end of the tournament and you get a night and that's it. So you don't get a lot of time to actually go out and do anything stupid.
So you make the most of that one night and go hard.
Yeah.
Okay, this is another one, probably similar. Favourite fight in the car park after a game? There must have been a few, was there?
Did Dylan Boucher ask that question?
Did you have a scrap with him?
No, not me. We played the Brisbane Bullets with the Breakers in Christchurch, and there was a bit of niggle in the game, and Dylan ended up getting ejected from the game. And afterwards, we're sitting in the were sitting in the changing rooms, and because he left the stadium,
yeah,
we left to the changing room. He'd already showered up, and he was all done, and so he wanders out, and he goes out into the car park out the back, and there's the Bullets are getting onto the bus,
yeah,
and there's another bit of confrontation, and he's standing there, and one of the Bullets guys just gives him one,
true,
yeah. And he comes back into the locker room, and he's got like this shiner on his eye. And so we got obviously Piero Cameron, Polder Winitana. And Polder was like a 6'4" Māori guy that was just absolutely diesel, like big dude. And Pauli Henare, which is another real nuggety point guard.
Yeah.
I've never seen them move so fast.
True.
They were just straight out into the car park, and all of the Brisbane guys are getting into the bus, and they're like, so there was not really a fight, but there was an incident which involved Dill, and and thankfully the Brisbane guys were on the bus. I hate to think what would have happened if those three had got their hands on them. Yeah.
Okay, best player you played against?
Best player, like, it's hard to probably look past LeBron, right? Yeah. But I think maybe from a European standpoint, Manu Ginobili was unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, just he was somebody that I like to sort of compare myself to in regards to, he was left-handed, he was a shooter, you know, and also he played a bit, obviously a little bit different game in the way I played, but yeah, he was phenomenal to watch and play against, and yeah, I love watching him play.
So would you mark someone like him? You obviously wouldn't mark LeBron, but...
Yeah, we matched up a little bit. We played against each other a few times. I just loved the way he played and his sense of the game, and he was experienced beyond his years, so he sort of understood the game early.
Yeah.
He was playing in the Italian league when he was like 18.
Oh, yeah.
And at a high level, you know, so he's pretty talented.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was cool. He was nice to watch play.
Was there anyone who you felt real uncomfortable defending? Like, you just felt like, man, I don't know how to defend this guy.
There was, when I played against guys in my position, generally they were a bit bigger than me.
Yeah.
So it was always a really physical battle with those players. So I did match up a little bit with LeBron.
Oh, did you?
Because he was playing like a guard spot for them.
Oh, true.
Yeah. And, you know, just physically he was like, oh, wow, you know, what do you do with that? Yeah, but there wasn't really anyone that probably stood out that was something I was scared of.
Yeah, you took them all down.
Yeah, I think just my nature was that I was going to compete.
Yeah.
I was going to give it a go.
Yeah.
At least, anyway. yeah. Might come off second best, but yeah.
Okay, last question. Best piece of advice you have for a Waterlad listener?
Well, I guess from a basketball perspective, if you've got kids that are involved or if you're a kid that's playing, you know, if you want to get better at basketball, you've got to put time in. You know, spending time on your phone or on your PlayStation is not going to get it done for you.
Yeah.
You got to put in the miles. You got to get shots up. You got to get your mates involved. You got to play as much as possible. You know, the more time on the court with the ball in your hand, it will. If you want to go somewhere with the sport, it will help.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's what I did. That's what my kids have done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's Hayden's reaping those rewards at the moment, but it's not because I was Dad's Phil Jones.
Yeah.
It's because he's put in the effort.
Mm-hmm.
He's put hours and hours and hours of time and down on the driveway with the hoop, shitty old ball.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the most important thing for all sports.
Yeah.
If you want your kids to excel or if you want to excel, put in the effort.
Yeah. I was going to say, it doesn't just stop at basketball. That's any sport or probably any job, really. Put in those hours, put in that time.
If you want rewards, do the hard yards, do the mahi.
Yeah, mate. Get the treats, mate. What a podcast. Awesome to sit down and go through your journey. Really appreciate you coming on, giving up your time. Big fan of yours growing up, going to the Nelson Giants games, always watching your – buckets go in, and it's been awesome to be able to just sit down and go through your journey and hear some of the yarns, but appreciate you coming on and giving up your time.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for having me.
Mate, you're a legend. Hey guys, thanks for listening, and if you've got this far, I'm guessing you enjoyed the episode. So if you did, please give it a share if you can, and also cheers to our mates at Spates for sponsoring this episode.